All right, so new unit, starting foraging. Looking back here, we've got the ARE and the UCE for the previous unit movement due this weekend. And then, this unit is three lectures long, so today, Tuesday, and Thursday. So the foraging reading and the foraging comprehension assignment will be due next Sunday. So the reading, I think, is a nice, kind of a cool little study that they did on these burrowing owls that, for reasons that they were studying in the paper, lined their burrows with mammal feces. And so the question was, why are they doing that? And they investigate a bunch of hypotheses. I really like this paper because it even creates like a table of hypotheses and predictions. So it's like, there are like these six hypotheses, and then there are these like seven things we could measure. And then so under this hypothesis, you would predict this set of outputs from those seven things. Under this hypothesis, you predict this set of seven things, and so on and so forth. And so by looking at how the actual data compares to these predictions across this grid, then they could gradually sort of say, well, it's definitely not these hypotheses, but there are a couple of hypotheses it might be. So it really shows this idea that there can be these multiple hypotheses you're investigating in one study. And in the end, you may not come down with just one hypothesis stands alone. It's not like a Highlander situation. It might be that there's might be two hypotheses that both work out. So that's something that I hope you take a look at. So I think, and I just in general, I think it's a good paper. So that's on perusal. Otherwise, the other thing to worry about is tomorrow, Friday. That's when your project group formations are due. So those that have maybe formed groups of three and looking for a fourth, or those who haven't been able to find a group, there is that spreadsheet on Canvas. If you go to the modules on Canvas and go down to the final project module, there's a spreadsheet link there that everybody has edit access to. Click on that Google Sheet and you can add your name if you're looking for a team or you're looking for somebody to join your team. Really prefer getting as many four-person groups as possible. So going into the weekend, I don't have to force those group associations. So that's the goal there. And then once you've got your group selected, then the next thing about 2 weeks later is you submit your, it's very brief. It's like a paragraph or two where you say, we're maybe even less than that. We're going to build our pitch for our project off of this organism, like a common grackle or a certain ant or black widows or whatever, and this particular context. So happen to notice that it seems like there are a lot more black widows in the city than there are out in the desert. And so we are going to pitch a study where we try to understand if that's the case and why that might be or how that's happening or something along those lines. So that's kind of the idea there. So the context there, you'd say, we're going to study black widows, and the context is the density in the city versus the density in the desert. It would be maybe one example. All right. So any questions about any of that moving forward? Okay, great. All right, so start out on the title slide with these California quail. There are quail that live near us, Gambel's quail, that look a lot like this. The males have got that thing coming out of their head there. And there's this like correlated characteristic on the females for these California ones. They also have kind of a little tail. So you'll see a pair here in a second. It'll cut over to them. So I just want you to watch this a little bit. Quail are an interesting bird. They've captured the imagination of behavioral ecologists, not for all of the normal birdie things they do while flying around necessarily, but for the stuff that they do on the ground. Their movement on the ground has a lot of interesting variations that raise questions, raise how and why questions for us. Consistencies across quail, but then within quail, variations that sometimes they speed up, sometimes they slow down, sometimes they hang out together, and so on. So, when you look at these things, I'll give it a second here. I think, yeah, they're going to do the characteristic runaway. So they can be very fast, is one thing here. So, again, we do have. There are a bunch of places, and you can hear them. They're very a characteristic call. So, if you've not seen these around here in Phoenix, So you hear like a call, like then they're nearby. And then after that, if you look around, it's like 4 p.m. kind of on kind of warm days. Sometimes just like they'll be just in the grass, just walking around, and they spook easily. But if you're standing from afar, I think they're really fun birds to watch. So when you look at these, a couple of things that I notice and is that, for one, they don't move at all at one speed. And it seems like they're pretty consistent about their speed for short periods of time, and then they will change. And so then, that raises these like, well, what's going on there? What are the hows and the whys there? What are the things that correlate with their speed? Like, what are the mechanisms there that are determining their speed? And then why might that have been selected? If, does that provide a functional value? And what would the value be? Likewise, you notice that there's, there was one quail that was off alone. These two are hanging out together. Why are there quail in different locations? Why are they at different densities? And how do those get maintained? Are there preferences for certain types of patches? So they don't seem to be foraging here on this, man-made surface. Maybe that makes sense. But even when you're out in the grass, seems that they're hanging out in certain areas, but not others. What's going on with that? Then there are different strategies of individual quail in response to social information. So, how do quail respond to other quail around them? And does that differ from quail to quail? And related to that, sometimes these quail have their heads up, they're looking around. Sometimes their heads are down, they're looking for food. How often do they spend their head time with their head up versus their head down? And these are all questions that invite, as us doing studies, trying to test hypotheses on these sorts of things. And these are all the types of things that we're going to be talking about in this unit, which is why I bring that sort of stuff up. Not all today, but this is trying to motivate the types of things that we're trying to answer in this unit. All right, so because this unit's about foraging, then the claim here is that all of those things, we can at least test hypotheses that have to do with food. And food is a major driver of movement. It's not only a major driver of movement for animals, but also for plants. What are plants? The easy definition, plants are planted. So plants don't move, at least not horizontally, not really, not very much. There are some exceptions, but generally speaking, they are in one spot, but they do move vertically. They are fighting for access to the sun. There have been intricate game theoretic models trying to explain the patterns you see in forest canopies about plants fighting each other for access to the sun. Plants that will shoot up as fast as possible and then umbrella out in order to shade out their competitors and get access to the sun. So, to a plant, the world is vertical. So they look kind of boring maybe to us because we're not used to moving in that direction. We're not used to moving at that time scale. But if you sort of look at them under time lapse, then you can see as interesting movements vertically as you can see in animals horizontally. So, but the key point here is like they're fighting for access to their energy source, which is the sun. They are autotrophs. They can make their own food. They don't rely on others. So that's kind of, a key thing. And of course that, that's a key difference between plants and then animals. Animals are animated. That's the key characteristic of animals. They can't stay in one place for too long because they can't get their energy from the sun. Their sun isn't always available. If they stay in one place for too long, eventually their energy depletes. It's finite energy in any one space, so they have to move. And they have to move for other reasons too. Plants can reproduce while standing in place. They have ways to send out their gametes, to send out their clones, et cetera, without having to move around. Animals, because animals are moving for to get their energy, animals to find other animals have to move to find the other moving animals. And so there's just a lot of horizontal movement. Animals are animated. But the key thing that is driving animals to be moving horizontally in the first place is food, is energy, the lack of infinite energy in one place. Thus, animals are heterotrophs. They need to get their energy by eating other organisms that have already gotten energy. So that's where we get to producers and consumers and so on. So it's basic ecology stuff. But point I'm trying to get here is that we spent a whole section last time talking about movement, and now we're talking about drivers of movement. And the claim here is that a key driver of movement is energy, is food, foraging. So when we look at these two, animals are animated, plants are planted. In the macroscopic world, animals are defined by their ability or need to move. And foraging is the term we're going to be using to describe the search over a wide area for food. If you happen to be holding peanuts in your hand and you drop them and you need to go and pick them back up, that's not foraging. That's, I don't know, caching and retrieval or something like that. But this is the idea that you don't have it, you don't know where it is, so you have to search for it. That's what we mean by foraging. Foraging is technically not the eating of the food, it's the searching for the food and the choices you make while searching. So actually taking the time to eat food prevents you from searching for other food. So eating is actually exiting out of the foraging task because you could be finding better food while you're eating. So the choice to eat is a costly choice. And that gets us to this very key concept in foraging theory, opportunity cost. The loss of potential gain from other alternatives when an alternative is chosen instead. So you're walking, you're in the MU, you decide to stop at Qdoba or whatever, you eat there, and you don't realize that a new place has just opened up and that might have been actually a better pick for you that day, but you decided to stop there. And so there's an opportunity cost of you deciding to stop to eat there. So it's that lost gain in a counterfactual world where you wouldn't have stopped and you kept on going. What's the difference between you in that world and you in this world? That's opportunity cost. And foraging is about the balance between what you can get now and what you could have gotten if you did something else. The balance between these things, opportunity cost. Any questions about what I mean by opportunity cost? This will be a key concept. We'll see it over and over and over again. All right. So, like on that idea, then, how do we start to capture this idea of opportunity cost in foraging? How do we connect the search for calories, the search for nutrients and calories, with the lost opportunity when you finally find something and decide to stop searching? How do we build those into something which maps to understanding reproductive success? So if we want to ask why questions, how do we ask why questions in terms of the search for food? How do we account for both the calories that we see the animal eating with the calories we don't see the animal missing out on? Certainly, natural selection sees both of those. If there are animals that are better at managing their opportunity cost, they will have higher reproductive success. How do we, as behavioral ecologists, try to account for that when we can't see the opportunities they're missing? So what we're going to try to do is build what we call fitness proxies. So we can't measure fitness. Sometimes we can measure fitness. Sometimes you can, raise an ant colony in your lab and watch how many brood they have, how many sexual brood they have. Those are the reproductive units of the ant colony. Likewise, there are other animals. You can actually watch how much reproduction. You can measure fitness. Or if you watch over a very long period of time and then you do genetic sampling, you can keep track of which animals happen to have more progeny, more offspring. So theoretically you can do that, but realistically you can't do that over short studies. You need to do that over very long studies, and it's very hard to generalize. So how do you come up with general principles and things that you can test? Like if you come up with a theory for those quail, I don't want to have to wait for those quail to reproduce to test my theory. Like I don't need to, like you could imagine, I'm going to look for quail somewhere in the world that do foraging one way, and I'm going to look for quail elsewhere in the world that do foraging another way, and I'm going to see how well they reproduce. That's just not a tractable study. So how do we do it so we can just look at those quail? And so we build fitness proxies. We build these indirect measures of fitness that we can measure. So, and I'll give you an example of that one in a second. So these are things that correlate, or at least makes sense that they correlate with fitness. And so one common example is, let's see if we can predict what an animal would be doing if they were simultaneously maximizing foraging gain while minimizing their foraging time. And the common way people do that is they say, let's figure out what the animal would do if it would maximize its rate of gain. So what behavior, if I was to think about all the behaviors this animal could do, can I estimate the gain divided by time? So if they forage for an hour, how many calories do they get in that hour? Calories divided by hour. Can I estimate that? And if I have multiple behaviors that have different rates of gain associated with them, then the prediction here, if this is a good proxy for fitness, is that animals that do the one with the higher rate of gain are going to be the ones that behavior will be more successful. And if that's a heritable behavior, then we'll see more of that behavior in the population. That's what we mean by a fitness proxy. Questions about what I mean by that? It's like, so we can't measure opportunity cost. And so what do we do? Instead of measuring opportunity cost, we measure foraging time, essentially. We say, are they getting the biggest bang for their buck? The thought is, no animal is going to maximize their calorie intake. It just doesn't make sense. Does anybody have a guess of why? Why does that not make sense that an animal would just sit around and maximize its calorie intake? What do you lose out on if you have a behavior that has been selected to just maximize your calorie intake? What's the cost of that? Not just metabolic cost and obesity and all that, but what's the ecological cost to having a behavior that gives up on everything else just to maximize energy gain? What do you mean by that? There you go. Reproductive cost. That's an opportunity cost. So if you're just sitting around like finding every berry in the forest, then you might survive to another day, but that survival to the other day will just be another day of looking for more berries. So you're never going to actually reproduce. And so that behavior probably isn't going to be selected. It's probably not going to spread through the population. If there was another behavior that managed to meet survival needs, but do it in a way that provides time for mating or time for, it's not just reproductive success, it could be for vigilance. If you keep your head down all the time looking for food and you don't see the predators ahead or above, then it's much more likely that you're going to get picked off. And so prey animals are frequently having to balance their time between finding food for themselves and keeping from being attacked by predators of them. So that's a big reason why this is a currency, a proxy that we think is much more likely to describe behaviors we see in nature than just calories alone. All right, any questions about that? We're going to build on this and make it more concrete. Okay. All right, so let's go back to our quail for this sort of example here. So I'm going to focus in on just the variable speed of this quail. And I'm going to focus in on an ultimate question of why might the quail be sometimes moving faster than others? What are the ecological drivers? What are the aspects of the environment that might be driving this quail? And why might it be, specifically, why might it be adaptive that a quail might be moving at different speeds? And so this is a question that was brought up in a famous paper by Gendron and Staden back in the early 80s. And they were testing a hypothesis that quail modulate their speed in order to find or deal with or respond to prey that are hard to see at high speeds. And so the different availability of prey, hypothetically, could lead to, if there's a bunch of prey that are very easy to see, maybe the quail will be able to move faster. But if all of the prey that are around are kind of camouflaged and very difficult to see, then maybe that's going to force the quail to move more slowly. And so if you know the availability of the different types of prey, you might be able to predict whether a quail is going to move fast or going to move slow. And if your predictions match what actually occurs, then maybe that this you provide support for this hypothesis that they have a behavior that's sensitive to the conspicuousness of prey. And that's what they built here. And so this little paper that they did here, it built off this thing, which we're going to drill down into, called Holling's disk equation. So here's the version here that we'll focus on. This was popularized by C.S. Holling. So this is also a kind of a famous theoretical ecologist. He worked in resilience as well. So like really prolific biologist. And so this Holling's disk equation here, what Holling did is he said he sat people, humans down at like a desk, and he put a bunch of sandpaper disks in front of them. And he just asked them to tap as many disks as possible, as fast as they could. And then he tried to then model or come up with a relationship that explained how quickly they could tap the disks based on how dense the disks were. So the thought was that, you know, this is modeling how a predator might respond to prey that get more and more dense in a habitat. So like at maybe at low densities, the predator, if you increase the density, you immediately see an impact on the catch of the predator. But maybe once you hit a sufficiently high density, then the predator becomes the limit itself, and it doesn't actually matter that you're going to get more density or less, because at that level, things aren't limited by the density, they're limited by the predator. That was kind of the idea here. And so he had people do this tapping of discs. And so this ends up being a rate of gain. This ends up being that fitness proxy that we were just talking about here. And so the things that go into this are the, you know, it this is the number of prey captured per unit time. It's a rate of gain again. So again, that's the number of discs tapped by the human per rate of time. It's Holling's disk equation. The handling time, this is modeling like if you are a predator and you capture a prey, once you capture it, it takes a certain amount of time to eat that prey. And while you're eating that prey, you can't be searching for other prey. That's the handling time. For someone searching for discs on a table, they might, you know, do a search, but once they've located a disc, they need to go down and tap that disc. That time it takes for them to move their finger down to touch that disc, that's the handling time in the human example there. So you can measure that. It takes half a second for someone to go and touch a disc. And then there's this instantaneous rate of discovery. And so for the human, that's that if you have a bunch of discs that are out there, if there was just one, if you take one of them, you could say, well, how long does it take for the human to go and hit that one, like just to move over there? And if you say, well, for all of them that are out there, on average, if you picked any one of them, how long would it take for someone to move their hand to that? That time, if you do the reciprocal of it, you get this rate, and that's this instantaneous rate of discovery. So it's you know, it sort of models how fast the predator is, how quickly you can move your finger around the table. And then finally, the density, the abundance of discs on the table. And so that's just, you just count them up. There's 100 discs on the table, so you know, this many discs per square meter. So you have all of those, and Holling found that this here described what was going on with the humans with the discs. And let's see what that looks like. So what we've got plotted here is R, this is the rate of gain on the y-axis, and the density on the x-axis. And it rounds off like this. And this shape is what Holling called a type two functional response. A type one, Holling said, would be just a straight line. You'd go up, and then once you hit the total number of discs, it would flatten out. So if you doubled the density, you would double the rate. A type three, Holling said, would look like an S shape. Like it would be kind of flat, it would go up, and then it would have an inflection point, and then it would round off. And Holling suggested that if predators were learning how to find prey, they would be more effective at learning at high densities than low densities, so they would have a shape one curve at the low densities and another curve at the high densities. But we're focusing on what's called this type two, which has this shape right here. And this is what he found with the humans tapping on it. And this is what we often use in our foraging models when we talk about predators and prey. And so what's going on here? If we look in this region over here, then it's basically the handling time is much less than the time it takes. Or I'll say, sorry, I'll say that a different way. The handling time is much less than the time it takes to actually find the next prey item. So if down here, when there's very low density, then it's basically saying, like, if it takes you 30 seconds to reach out to find these discs, then it doesn't really matter that it takes you half a second to tap the discs, because the 30 seconds is what's driving how quickly you can tap the discs. And in this low region down here, if you were to increase the density, you would see an almost exact increase in the number of discs you tap or the prey you capture. So it's almost a line here where if you increase, by 10% increase in density gives you 10% increase in how quickly you can tap the discs or how quickly a predator can capture prey. But eventually what happens is that up here, when things are really dense, at this point, it's so easy to find the next prey. It's so easy to find the next disc. It's just right next door. So at that point, you're really limited by how the time it takes to actually go and touch the disc. And so it doesn't matter if you go from 400 discs to 500 discs, it doesn't really make that much of an impact, because what's keeping you from getting a higher prey capture rate is the time it takes for you to actually touch the disc. You're wasting time touching the disc when you could be searching. All right, so does that make sense? Are there questions about this shape? What's being communicated here? I mean, the key idea is this handling time. If your handling time was zero, so it just you instantaneously could eat a prey, then this denominator would just be a one. It would just drop off, and then your intake rate would just be the density times the rate at which, basically times your speed. So as fast as you could move, if you move twice as fast, you have a double your intake rate. That's basically what you can think of this A as, like, your speed times density. But if your handling time is infinite, so then that means you're going to spend so much time eating a prey item that you're just never going to get around to eating any other prey items. And so then this denominator here becomes infinite. And so the whole R basically goes to zero. So that's what we're sort of seeing here, this competition between how fast you are and how long it takes for you to actually eat the prey. Aren't any questions about that? It's a fundamental idea. Pauline, yes. Yeah. Those are two. I would say it's both. So, like, you could say that what are different ways that you can limit your prey availability? If you slow the predator down, that has the same impact as if you make it far. More sparser in terms of prey. So in terms of the time you spend searching, then you're going to spend more time searching on the left, either because there's very little prey or you're just very slow. Whereas on the right, you're going to spend more time eating. So predator limited, prey limited. Well, I mean, I guess it's predator limited in terms of speed, but it's like environmentally limited, like it's search limited or processing limited. That's maybe a better way to view it. Any other questions about that before we move on, we make this more exciting? All right, so that's the basic Hollings disk model. And that's what a lot of foraging models are based on, a version of this. And Genard and Sadin, it was that was the same idea. They were just as interested in modifying this for their quail problem in order to say, okay, if that's a fitness proxy for our quail, how do we make predictions about cryptic prey in this fitness model? And they said, well, What we're going to do is we're going to model the probability of detection based on the search speed. And so what they're basically doing is taking A, which is a little bit like the speed parameter. It's like one divided by the average time it takes for you to find the next prey item or any individual prey item. And we're breaking it up into two parts. We're saying that there is that the search rate ends up giving you a probability of detection so that you might run into an object, a prey item. But if you're going so fast that your sensory system can't see it, then you're not actually going to experience it. So it's as if it's not there. So that's what we see kind of built up here is that we've got our instantaneous encounter rate. That's like if you could see it, you would actually experience it as, you actually see the prey. But because you're moving so fast, your probability of detection filters a bunch of those out. So you're just missing out on a bunch of them because you're traveling so fast that your probability of detecting any of them is really low. And so that creates a much lower A for your Hollings disk model. So this gives a way to, for one prey type, and then more interestingly, for two prey types of different conspicuousness, a way to predict what the optimal search rate, the fitness, a fitness proxy, a stand-in for fitness. It's a way to predict for different environments. Like you've got two prey that are both conspicuous. You got one prey that's conspicuous, one prey that's cryptic. You got different densities of both. So under these different hypothetical scenarios, you can predict what the best speed is for that animal. And then you can see if the patterns of speed match the real quail. That's what we're building up to. So before we get to that, and I get, add more wrinkles to this, are there questions about this idea that they're adding in to the standard Hollings disk model, a model of detection probability based on speed, making it harder to see certain prey? Oh yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So there's different curves here. So the idea here is that this is they said, well, we don't know for the quail sensory system, what that relationship actually is, the relationship between speed and probability of detection. We think that at some top speed, that the quail just can't see anything. And at some low speed, it can see everything. But how you get from there to there, it could be a number of different curves. And so they were modeling, they said, well, for different bends here, then you could say, this is like for this quail, it's really hard to see things at any speed. But for this quail, it can see things at pretty high speeds and then it drops off right at the end. So they can model different sensory systems and their sensitivity to speed. So this is high sensitivity to speed, and this is low sensitivity to speed. And then they can do a sensitivity analysis to see, do our predictions make sense only for really sensitive animals? Or do our predictions match for all sensitivities? That's kind of the idea there. Does that make sense? Yeah, the one on the right, you're maintaining. You can see things up until 80% of your max speed, and then after that, it falls off. But the one on the left, you can see things that when you're stopped, but if you get even 20% of your max speed, then you're already falling off. So you're really sensitive to speed on the left, and you're not very sensitive to speed on the right. Any other questions? Okay. Promise I'm not going to make you solve for anything. It's just looking at the graphs. So this is two examples of exactly that. So we have a hypothetical animal, a hypothetical quail that is is not very sensitive to speed, k equals 2, that's this upper curve. And then another quail is very sensitive to speed, k equals 0.6 down here. And so this now, instead of thinking this as two different quail, let's now think of this as one quail, but two different prey. So now we're saying that this is how well you can see. This is a very conspicuous prey item. So what we're saying here is that as you get faster, you pretty much can see that prey item until you get really, really fast. But this prey item down here, this prey item, you can really only see when you're stopped. So before I talked about these being multiple different quail with different sensory systems. Now we're saying, let's just imagine it's one quail, but we have things very visible prey and very cryptic prey. And we got two different prey coexisting. And what does the quail do in terms of that? And so what we see over here is that if you just give the quail the cryptic prey, and then you solve for the optimal search speed using that Hawking's disk equation, then you get a slow search speed. If you instead give the quail a prey that is very conspicuous, then you get an optimal, very fast search speed. And that matches kind of what we would expect. So it kind of gives us an idea that the model's doing something correctly. It's kind of what we were expecting there. So, but the point here is that in both cases, there's a middle speed. At no time is it good to go at your top speed, and no time is it good to go at your bottom speed. But so for really cryptic prey, there's a slow speed that we would expect a high fitness quail to go at. And for conspicuous prey, there is a high speed that we would expect high fitness quail to move at. So that's our first test of the model before we get, and now, you know, then we went, the real test is the where we get to predictions that we can test in the field where we combine two different types of prey simultaneously. This is, they're still alone. There's two different types, but we consider them alone. Questions about this? Do we see, does everybody understand the relationship between this probability detection graph and this prey capture rate graph? Okay. The K, that is the conspicuousness. That's the that so K determines whether this bows out or bows in. If it's less than one, it bows in. If it's greater than one, it bows out. So K equals one is a straight line. Okay. Question, other questions? All right. So now what we're going to do is consider a hypothetical case where there are two prey simultaneously, one that's cryptic and one that is conspicuous, one that you can see at lots of speed and one that you really can only see at slow speeds. And we're going to change the relative availability of both. So what we see on the x-axis now is relative density of species one. Species one is the one you can see at all speeds, relatively all speeds. At high speed, you can still see species one. Species two prey, you really only can see at low speeds. So you put both of those there. We're going to hold the density of the cryptic prey constant, and then we're going to change the density of the one that you can see. And that's what we see here. So what the predictions are that at low densities of the conspicuous prey, then we see a ramp up of the optimal search rate until some critical point where it flattens out. And it flattens out at the density you'd expect if you only had the conspicuous prey. So what you're seeing here is that the optimal prediction, and this is all reflected in this one over here as well, the frequency in the diet here. So this is saying that this is the frequency of prey one in the diet. After some critical density of prey one to prey two, then these all go to 100% prey one. So once the conspicuous prey becomes frequent enough, it's easy enough to find, the optimal quail ignores the cryptic prey. It just doesn't care. If it sees it or not, it doesn't care. It's not worth the opportunity cost to slow down to look for the cryptic prey. So we're just going to ignore it and go as fast as possible, because if we go as fast as possible, there's enough conspicuous prey out there to actually have us meet, you know, to do really well in terms of this fitness proxy. So only when there's very few conspicuous prey do you adjust your behavior to start looking for cryptic prey. And this is something that we can now test, and people have done this, that you can, you know, bring quail or other birds into the lab, and you can give them prey that look like the background, and then you can give them prey that really stand up against the background. You have to confirm that one's more cryptic than another, and so on. You'd have to confirm that you get them moving slower when it's only cryptic and faster when it's only conspicuous. And then you can change the relative amounts of the two of them in your lab setup. And you can see, is there a critical point where once you have a certain number of conspicuous prey, the animal just stops eating the cryptic prey entirely? And if it does, then that agrees with this prediction. And it suggests that the animal's modulating its speed in order to deal with these sensory constraints. Questions about that? Clear the idea here. Scan. My peripheral vision is not, so it's a cryptic, the sitting there and there. So I have to remember to not ignore the sides there. Conspicuous means easy to see. So inconspicuous means you're kind of hiding, and conspicuous means you're out and have a lot of contrast and very easy to see. Okay. So it's all about diet availability is what's supported here. And this does have some support in trying to understand the variations in speed patterns we see in quail and in other predators. I've actually been involved in a couple of other projects that have to do with predator speed. And there are other things that drive predator speed too, but the point is that it's very rare across the animal kingdom the predators move at their top speed. For a long time, people thought that's how you characterize predators, their top speed. And so a predator that had a higher top speed was more vicious. Well, but in reality, like predators that have a higher top speed, we're more interested in why they don't use that top speed. What does that mean for the lower speeds that they have? And, so there can be sensory trade-offs. So as you move at your top speed, you might not be able to see things. And so you only move at your top speed when you live in an environment where everything's very, very, very obvious, or maybe when you're not very hungry. But there also can be, and that's not mentioned here, biomechanical trade-offs. And we see that as well, is that if a predator, very often predators that are very fast have a bone structure that makes them not very maneuverable. Domestic cats are an exception. And that's why domestic cats, we think, are decimating Australia, because the marsupial population there was not adapted for that type of predator. And so most predators that are adapted there, if you have clearings, the predator will take shortcuts. And that means it doesn't have to be maneuverable. But if you have an open forest, a slow prey is often more maneuverable. And that slow prey will then move in circuitous routes in order to force the predator to move in circuitous routes, because that will force the predator to move at slower speeds. And then that can, so you can actually have a predator whose tops, or a prey whose top speed is well under the predator, actually is faster than the predator in the natural habitat, because they managed to get the predator to going go routes that require tight bends that the predator can't make unless it slows really far down. So there's all these explanations for trying to figure out why predators don't run at their top speed. And this was just one example of that. Here it's about the sensory system and the diet availability. So the big example here that I want to take away from this is how we use that fitness proxy, is that, we could try to address a why question. Why do we see variations in speed? By using a fitness proxy that we can measure and model, and then adapt that fitness proxy to fit our hypotheses, and then test the predictions of that fitness proxy under higher hypotheses to see if they match the patterns we see in nature. And that's a way we can use models and math to test why questions, to test functional questions. Any questions about that? So this is a special problem to me. It's close to my heart, because my very first paper was adapting this idea to autonomous vehicles. And so at that time, people were trying to, they always would send autonomous vehicles out at one speed. And so there are questions of saying, well, is there sometimes good for things to be slow? And why would it be good to be slow? And then we said, well, you know, this idea of this sensory idea is a good one. Can we take the general concept that Jenner and Stadtid did, and then I generalize the math to make it more, make it something that you don't need a computer solver to solve, that you can solve very quickly without simulations, and you can apply it to a wider range of cases. And then that was able to then be applied on mobile vehicles. And so then those vehicles, based on their sensory constraints, could choose to slow down based on not only what they potentially could sense, but the things that they needed to sense at the time. So that's kind of the cool thing about this quail problem, is that the quail's not only picking out its speed, it's picking out its diet too, simultaneously. It's saying, like, I'm going to choose not to eat this object or this prey, and because of that, I'm going to allow myself to go faster. But it's got those 2 degrees of freedom that it has to deal with simultaneously. My diet, if it chose a bigger diet, it would have to choose a slower speed to enable that diet. So somehow the quail has a mechanism, a how question. How is the quail figuring out how to do that? This is how we answered, and I'm not, I mean, this is just an equation from that paper, but this is how we answered it for a robot. We said that here is a mechanism that we propose that will lead to the Jenrin-Instadon solution using things that the robot can calculate. It is a mechanism that is implementable on a robot that will lead to that simultaneous choice of what things am I going to do today and how fast am I going to look for them? That simultaneous choice. That's like the interesting question. So we got an artificial system to do it, but then the next question you could ask about the quail is, well, then what is the neurological mechanism that is allowing the prey, the quail to do that, to make those simultaneous decisions? We know it seems to be making those decisions, but we don't know how. So that's the next thing you could go towards. All right, so any questions about that before we switch gears to a much slower animal? All right. So why are animals slow? That's sort of the key thing that links these two examples together. So sloth behind me. And so that's one question you could ask. Why are sloths slow? And we'll come back to that right at the very end. But there's another question that you can ask about sloths and their movement that has to do with, why do sloths move? You know, normally when you see a sloth, if you've ever seen a sloth in the wild, or if you've seen the sloth at the zoo, normally they're hanging on to a tree somewhere, just up in the tree, just doing their thing. And wonder why do they move? They have leaves available to them, but they eat them very, very slowly. Maybe they need to move around to get more leaves. That makes sense. But generally speaking, there's not a lot of reason for a sloth to move. And there's a particularly puzzling movement problem that people, that behavioral ecologists have tried to figure out, and eventually came up with this really interesting story, is not just how they move among the canopy, but the question of why do they ever come down the tree, and why do they come down the tree to poop? That's the key question here. Why come down a tree to poop? It is perfectly reasonable to poop from the tree. Right? I mean, they still might have to hang on to the tree down here, just drop it from up there, right? And yet, this is expend a huge amount of energy. You got to control your descent down the tree, and then you got to climb back up the tree. And this is an animal that eats leaves. Leaves are deficient in like everything. That's why sloths have tiny little brains. They're generally, not very smart animals. They don't have a lot of capacity up there. They don't get a lot of energy from their leaves. The leaves are somewhat toxic, so there's a koala issue kind of going on there too. There's a lot of weird, like, it's hard. That is a niche that they have found a way to survive on, but that is not a very productive niche. It's just a niche, that someone needed to exploit, and sloths, they fit into that community. They fit into that niche, but it's not a niche that would suggest a lot of movement. And yet, this is how they defecate. And defecation, as you know, is a pretty important thing for an animal to do. So what's going on there? Well, it turns out there is a very complex and interesting story involving a mutualism which explains this behavior. And so let's walk through that. And it does then tie to foraging. It does then tie to this issue of how do they get their nutrients and how do they get protected from being eaten by other things that might eat them. So there's foraging all over the place here. So as I mentioned, they spend most of their time in trees. They eat nutritionally poor leaves, relatively small brains, sedentary lifestyle, very little energy. And when the other puzzling thing about them is if you look at a sloth, 3% of its biomass, so for me that's like a gallon of water. So it's like imagine if I was covered in a gallon of water's worth of algae right now. That's a sloth. So that's a lot of biomass that it, you know, that's the green that's covering their fur. So in the picture that you saw, the real picture, and you can kind of see it drawn in here. So they have a lot of algae on them too. So they have this algae on them and it's growing and they do eat from that algae. And that algae does seem to provide them a lot of things that their leaves don't. So it is an important source that, you know, to get that algae and to maintain that algae on their bodies is something that's important. So remember those things. So that's the background for the sloth here. So let's think about them climbing down this tree and what happens. Well, it turns out that, you know, they descend from these trees and they defecate. And it turns out that there are moths in this sloth fur, and we'll come back to why they're there. But those moths in a sloth fur, when the sloths come down, these moths will often come off the sloth, go into the sloth poop, and lay eggs. And then they'll go back into the sloth there, but then the eggs then are now in the sloth poop. And those eggs, when they develop into larvae, the larvae is coprophages. So what does coprophages mean? Anybody know what's a copra? Yep. Eats poop, right? These are poop-eating larvae, poop-eating maggots. So they are down in here and they're eating the poop. They're eating the poop or whatever as a sloth can go back up the tree. So the moths laid their stuff in the poop. The larvae ate the poop. The larvae develop into moths. The sloth is up the tree. Well, what do moths do? They fly up. And what do they find? They find a nice big healthy sloth there. And they then take up residence in their fur. So you have a bunch of moths that are living in the fur of the sloth. What happens to moths eventually? They die. So you have living moths and dead moths in the fur of this sloth. So then what's going to happen to those dead moths? Well, it turns out there's also a fungus that lives in the sloth fur, and that fungus breaks down the dead moths and it releases nutrients into the fur that are perfect for, guess what? Algae to grow. So it appears like the only way you get the algae to grow is if you've got the dead moths being broken down by the fungi. So you get this giant cycle here where the sloths have to come down, they have to poop, the moths have to lay their eggs in the poop, the moths have to lay back down on the sloth has got to have the fungi in them, the moths have to die there, the fungi have to then break down the moths to then produce, to give the algae a place to live, which feeds the sloth, which keeps it alive, which keeps it pooping, and so on and so on. So it is a four-way mutualism that helps to explain why sloths do the crazy thing of spending so much energy to come down a tree to poop. Because if they pooped in the trees, then it wouldn't be in a convenient place for the moths to find it to lay their eggs in it. And it wouldn't be in a convenient place for the moths that develop in the poop to find the sloth again. Which I think is a really cool thing. The algae that the sloth needs to eat, it wouldn't be there if there weren't dead moths in its fur. The dead moths wouldn't be there if there weren't larvae developing in the sloth poop. And the sloth poop wouldn't be there if there wasn't a sloth there. So the sloth needs the algae needs the moths need the poop. There you go, circle of life. Sloths need the algae. Yep. Sloths need the algae, moths need the poop, algae needs the dead moths, and so on. Yep. I don't know. That's a great question. I'm sure there's a moth or there's a sloth expert that they would find that, but I know it's important. I know that like there's I mean if I go back here, there are a bunch of these are not like bioavailable in the leaves that they eat. And so I mean theoretically some of these things like in elemental form, you could probably find them in leaves, but the fact that they're sort of bioavailable for the sloth to then incorporate, that's sort of the issue. So I think it's a lot. Yeah. I think like the leaves provide, fiber, like a lot of leaves, like that's the big thing a lot of leaves provide. And the other thing, like, why are dinosaurs, why are herbivore dinosaurs gigantic? Anybody know? Because or it's also a lot of ruminants are very large animals. And it's because you get so little out of leaves, you have to kind of let them stew in large piles for a long amount of times. And so animals that eat leaves often have digestive systems that are much more like little tiny bits of your, like, if you think of a human A&P and you're thinking you're going through the GI tract and there's like duodenums and other things and things that, like, you're like, oh, it's just this little hanger on. If you look at like a koala's GI tract or a sloth's GI tract, these things are gigantic. They take up a huge amount of the gut. Like, it's just like a totally different resource allocation. And it's to allow leaves and other things like leaves to sit there for long periods of time because you need, in order to break them down, it's so hard to break them down, you just can't pass them through. So, a lot of cool things that go on, getting leaves. But the whole point is leaves, you don't eat a leaf and expect, it's like, eating a salad with just lettuce. Like, it's probably not going to be very rewarding. And so, this is sort of the salad dressing for the sloths of these algae. Any other questions? It's a very good question. I wasn't trying to be dismissive. It's just I'm not a sloth expert. All right. So, yeah, it's a cool cycle for sloths. So sloths come down trees to poop because their leaves are nutritionally poor. I think it's a really cool story there. But it does, we can go full cycle here. And I mentioned like one of the things that links the sloth to the quail is trying to understand why animals move slowly. So, in the quail could move fast, but they move slow. In the case of the sloth, why is there a slow niche? And there's a colleague of mine who's now the dean of engineering at UCI, Magnus Egerstedt. And he started developing this when he was a faculty at Georgia Tech. And so he's developed this sloth bot. And because he also, I think he wrote a book on this, I don't think I've got it here, on why robots might be slow. So we kind of converged on this. I got to it first, but we kind of converged on this question independently. And so he was interested in environmental monitoring tasks. And so he was trying to think like, if we wanted to create robotic adaptations that could last for very long periods of time, taking data in a spot in the environment without human intervention, how would we make that work? If it needs to move around a little bit, it needs to harvest the sun and these sorts of things. And so they did a lot of reading on how sloths work and then tried to build vehicles that kind of mimic some aspects of sloths. And they called it a sloth bot, and they thought that was a more effective. So it was his example of that. Rather than building fast robots, like a lot of people were interested in, like get excited about slow robots. And so that's kind of a more ecological perspective on design, which I think I like. But that's just an aside. And that's sort of our foundations here. So any questions about this idea? Big thing I want to take away: opportunity cost, huge. We're going to see that over and over again in the next two lectures. And this idea of fitness proxies is another kind of big one. And this in general, that nutrient constraints can cause weird behaviors. And we're going to close out the foraging section seeing more examples of that. Okay. So yeah, didn't really talk about it a whole lot here. Fitness proxy, type 2 functional report response, Hawling's disk equation. Hawling's disk equation, good thing to know. So with that, there's your reminders, and let's do a clicker, and we'll get you out of here. All right. So for your multiple choice, not multiple choice, for your short answer, just give me an example of something that represents an opportunity cost to eating something. So it could be somebody already gave an example during the class. Like, just give an example. It could be, as short as possible. Just keep it concise so it's easier for me to review. But the idea is, an animal has stopped to eat something and they're taking time to eat something. What is the opportunity cost? What is an example of an opportunity cost to taking the time to monopolize your time just eating something? So what are other things you could be doing with your time, basically? And that's all I've got for you. So I hope you have a good weekend. Get your team selections in. I'll hopefully finalize those then over the weekend, and we'll see you for Foraging 2 on Tuesday.